Good morning, everybody. We're going to be learning about an event which really borders on history and our identity and our Torah, which happened 100 years ago and 3 days. So this is a very important moment in history. We're going to thank our sponsors, Mr. Suzanne Cohen, who's sponsoring Le'ilu Nishmas, her father-in-law, Mr. William Cohen, Zev Ben Eliezer Yitzchak HaKoyhen, Mes Hashem Nishmosai Eden. Thank you for sharing it with us. I'd like to just learn with you briefly about this really astounding event which occurred 100 years ago. So we're all familiar with the outline, the Balfour Declaration, which occurred on November 2nd, was issued on November 2nd, 1917. Here we go, as an example, let's see if we can get to the Balfour Declaration itself. This is the declaration. You know, we sort of expect, you know, a drum roll, a whole ream of paper. It's one letter. One letter. Dear Lord Rothschild, double spaced, I have much pleasure in conveying to you on behalf of His Majesty's government. There was a king at the time. And the following declaration of sympathy with the Jewish Zionist aspirations, which is submitted to and approved by the cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home. That's a very important word. Of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration of knowledge to the Zionist Federation. This is the Balfour Declaration. Essentially, it is England, Lord Balfour, who was, in fact, the previous Prime Minister, not previous, but he was an original Prime Minister, his term ending in 1906, now in the Foreign Office, representing the government of England, representing His Majesty the King, now issuing this document, essentially recognizing not just the right, but also the willingness to facilitate this. Well, of course, it's hedging at the end, with the two hedgings just at the end, just to be clear, is right now Jews constitute 3% of that particular vast area called the Palestine area of the Ottoman Empire. And number two is, so it's not going to affect the other people to a certain degree. That's a bit of a hazy statement. And number two is the concern about worldwide Jewry suffering because of this, anti-Semitism rising because of this. So therefore, he made those two declarations as part of this plan. Now, it's a very strange thing to say for numerous reasons. Just let's appreciate this for a second. Does Britain actually have control of Palestine? The answer is no. The answer is no. We're in 1917. Right now, we're in the middle of World War I, just to appreciate this. In fact, we're on the cusp, America's on the cusp of entering the war. We're talking about the Triple Entente, Britain, France, and Russia fighting. We're talking about the Central Powers, Austria-Hungary, Germany, trench warfare, and the war going across the world. At this point in time, there has been a battle in October with the British and Australian troops, the Battle of Beersheba, which conquer the area, this lower area, the southern regions of Palestine. But at this point in time, the war hasn't finished yet. The outcome of the war is still in the air. And number two is, Britain at this point in time happens to be one of three, at least, allies. I mean, they can't make a unilateral decision about where this land's going to go over here. They were fighting with allies. The whole thing is quite a remarkable notion in the first place. In fact, studying a little bit of history, in 1916, the year beforehand, two of the allies, France and Britain, had already drawn up the Picard-Sykes plan. So these were two representatives from France and from Britain who divided up a division plan of the Middle East. Very simple, you know, not considering the native populations. They just pulled out, you know, this was a negotiation. So France really had interests in the Levant, in the Syria area, and England had more interests in the lower area. And because Palestine itself, the Palestine area of the Ottoman Empire, the division of the Ottoman Empire being one of the great causes of the Great War itself, because everybody had their eyes on this empire which was falling apart, this is exactly what they wanted. So the lower area, Britain and France both had their eyes on. And so therefore there was this debate, and the way they negotiated was that in fact there would be, France would get a pretty large section of it. They'll be on the international zone, on the lower section. It wasn't so simple, meaning to say this Balfour Declaration came out against this particular plan of division, which gave Britain more space than they actually had in this original plan. So this is we need to consider it historically speaking. There happens to be a lot of very fascinating history, and by the way, just is interesting to notice, Kurdistan, which still is waiting, right? Still under referendum, right? It is interesting to me as a side note that if people are really care about nationals having their own territory, that doesn't sound like it's everybody's interest across the board. Meaning, when Iran talks about the Zionist occupation, they're not worried about the Syrian and Turkish occupation of Kurdistan. They're different nationals that matter differently in world history. But nonetheless, so that was the plan. So what happened? During these years, there are two figures who were very influential in English politics. This is Dr. Chaim Weizmann, who was in fact a biochemist who arrived in, I believe, 1904 to England, well-distinguished individual, one of the proponents of the Zionist movement, and of course, Nachum Sokolow. Nachum Sokolow today, we don't remember so much. We don't know there's Sokolow streets in Israel. There's a kibbutz named after him, but we don't have so much information on him. These two individuals are the people who started speaking to the powers that be, speak to the British advisors, and after much communication, the British realized it was interesting that Mr. Sykes himself, who was the proponent of that plan, whether he realized altruistically the Zionist ideal was something which he believed in, or whether he believed it would be something which could advance the British cause in getting more land in the Palestine area, whichever way there's a debate as to how altruistically motivated he was, really actually fully adopted this cause. And the problem was that Britain couldn't do anything without France or America. They weren't able to issue such a thing. So in fact, Mr. Sokolow took a trip to France and gained in writing an acceptance to the forthcoming Balfour Declaration, had a milestone meeting with Pope Benedict XIV, who was now in Rome in the middle of that trip, and for the first time, the Pope actually gave blessing to the notion of a homeland. This is what was happening in the years 1916, 1970, leading up to the Balfour Declaration. At this point in time, Louis Brandeis, who had come into office, had the ear of Woodrow Wilson, who gave a non-public affirmation of the forthcoming Balfour Declaration, and that was why the Balfour Declaration was actually able to happen politically. Meaning to say, it was with the permission of those other powers, but of course it wasn't until 1920, after the war had finished, after the conquest had happened, that then there was the conference in San Remo, where the powers came together, where France, Britain, England, Japan, and Italy came together for a conference in which they wanted to actually legalize this that declaration, which by then, at this point in time, could actually be made because Britain actually controlled this. And that was when the British Mandate of Palestine was created in response to or in the continuation of the Balfour Declaration. It is interesting to note that it was not smooth at any point in time. France tried to back out in 1919 because Vayakom Melech Chadash Asher Lo Yada Eschayim. So Nachum. You know, there was a lot of complications, but nonetheless, it came to being in the San Remo conference, and of course later on in the League of Nations, confirmed this later on in 1922. So this is a really fascinating time in history, and really the perspective that we need to take on this is, you know, it's wonderful, it's a blessing. How do we react to that? I mean, like, what is our role essentially in looking at that? In looking at something that happens. Under the following auspices. The first place to look is how does Geula itself arrive? You know, people were, you know, had shine in their eyes. They were looking towards this. This is the moment of ultimate redemption. How does Geula actually happen? So, in perhaps one of the most famous Gemaras that most people know, quoting the pasuk in Yeshayahu, Yeshayahu says in Perek Samach, Hakotoni ele elef atzoir legoy atzum, that the smallest one will be to a chiefdom. And the small nation will be to a great nation. Ani Hashem b'itachish, and I'll bring it fast. I'll bring it at its time, speedily. Oxymoron, speedily at its time. How does that work? The Gemara famously says in Sanhedrin, quoting Rabbi Alexandria and the Nabi Yeshua, b'itachish, shema zachu achishena lezachu b'itach. So you know how Geula comes? If we have the schus, if we really merit it, yes, then it comes at the right time. Then it comes early. If we don't have a schus, then there's a deadline. And that deadline will come. Deadline 6,000 years. Where we are on that, historically speaking, is a matter of fascinating debate. But nonetheless, there seems to be two modes of how Geula comes. This is the famous part. The only thing we need to think about carefully when we're looking at this Gemara over here is who is doing the Achishena. Right? Like let's think about this for a second. Who is doing the Achishena? In this the Gemara or the Pasuk in Yeshayahu is describing it is who's doing it? Hashem, right? It doesn't sound like we're doing it. If we're our role in this whole equation is creating the schus, the merit that Hashem should be meichesh the Yeshua, so Hashem should speed along that redemption. So where does that line, you know, where do you draw the line between accruing schus and bringing it forward, right? Meaning, you know, how much political, you know, meetings, how many lobbies do we need to say are part of the, you know, the schus, and how much is the achishena? Where's Hashem's part in this? It sounds, at this point in time, we could say we should really be passive in terms of the political, military front, and maybe only in the spiritual front we're doing something. Right, there's a lot of space over here. So, what is our existence as a godless Jew? For this, we need to return to a Gemara, which relates to a pasuk in Shir HaShirim. The pasuk in Shir HaShirim describes for us, I would say, like once we absorb this, it's like it's almost a very tragic way to think about history, but it is a true way of thinking about history that the Gemara describes. The pasuk in Shir HaShirim says, "Yishpati yaschem benos Yerushalayim." You know, daughters of Jerusalem, I have sworn to you today, says God, you should not wake up the love until the time of desire has arrived. You should not wake up the love until the time of desire has arrived. What does it mean, wake up the love? Gemara is pretty clear about this. In Ksubas, famous Gemara says, Rabbi Yehuda quotes this. We're going to start from over here. We're going to start from Rabbi Zera. Rabbi Zera, who mi boi lelechet Rabbi Yossi, b'Rabbi Chanina. Dama, Gimel, Shvuos, Halalu, Lama. There were three oaths that Hashem swore to us, made us swear as we went into exile. Achas, Shlo, Yalu, Yisrael, Bechoma. One oath is that we should not go up, Bechoma literally means, like, Bechoma literally means a wall in power together. Vachas, Sheshpia, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Es Yisrael, Shlo, Yimredzu, Bo'omos Ha'olam. Number two is that we shouldn't rebel against the nations of the world. And the third one, Sheshbi HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Esa Ovde Kochovim Shlo Yishtabdu Bohen B'Yisrael Yosei Mirdai. And the third one is that Hashem turned to the nations of the world and said, in a certain sense, you're the steward of my nation throughout all of history, and make sure don't overdo it. This is what we have, what's famously known as the three oaths, the Gimel, the Shalosh Shavuos, which has been the topic of not just discussion, but books, Sforim, volumes have been written about this particular Gemara. Because ultimately, what's our question over here is, what is our Jewish identity in exile? How active are we supposed to be? Are we supposed to ascend in the ranks of society? Are we supposed to change political agenda? Or are we supposed to remain simply at the bequest or at the will of the government that we're under? This is the question that this Gemara raises. And it seems pretty clear from the simple reading of this Gemara is that we're not supposed to have access to the land of Israel there isn't actually an until in this Gemara. It sounds like it shouldn't be our role. Reading, going back to the Gemara about in Sanhedrin, when is Geula come? Hachishen, Hashem says, you know what? I'll bring it along. I'll sort it out. You wait. You do your thing. What's your thing? Stay put. Work within the systems that you've been given. Work within the countries that you've been given, and we'll take it from there. Now, are there any ways around this? Meaning to say, like, are there limitations to this? Like, how extreme is this? How far does this reach? Not so simple, right? Okay, so one of the things, one of the questions that the poskim ask about this is, as Dr. Yeager is pointing out, is this a package deal? So I mean to say, if it's a package deal, then it might be bilateral. So therefore, what happens if, let's say, you know, we go to the 1400s, and we read about about Otto Dufe. Let's read about Holocaust. And say, well, you know, that sounds a little bit like Yoser Midai. That sounds a little bit like what's happened when we read about the Crusades. Is that what God envisioned? You know, when he said that Ummah Sa'alam should not over oppress us? It sounds like that part of the deal has been off for a very long time. And the question is, so does that affect the first part of the shua? Are those three shuas interdependent? Another question we could ask ourselves as well is how much is choma? What does choma mean? Does the choma mean to say militarily? What about diplomatically? Is that also choma? Like, is that forceful by forcing, you know, Chaim Weizmann and Nachum Sokolov? Are the diplomatic efforts part of the choma as well? How far does it go? What happens if it's segments of the Jewish population? It's not all together. What happens if it's in a few stages of Aliyah? How far reaching is this Gemara, Barbara?
So does that mean that we're not allowed to go when we're in those nations, or when we're against those nations? So is it saying, like, if you're in Israel, you can, because you're in Israel, but if you're living within and under the subjugation of another power, then you're not allowed to
go? Good question. I'm not particularly sure. It sounds like it's in the context of Israel finding independence. Meaning to say, the topic over here is not about we'll call it the nationalism or the of that particular country. It's about really about Israel's independence. So we're not supposed to break free and create sovereignty. That's what it sounds like. So that's really the groundwork of the debate. So what I want to do is to say, well, you know, it's very hard to choreograph from that Gemara exactly what should happen. But you know what we can do instead of that? We can say, well, what did happen? So let's look at history, and let's look at attempts in Jewish history where Jews very ideologically decided, yes, we want to do this. We need Geula. We want to bring it forward. We're going to take the next active steps, and how successful and unsuccessful they are. I'm just taking four examples just before we get to this. Four precedents in history, and these will give us just a little bit of the wherewithal to have continue the conversation as we get to the 1917s. We're going to follow the Ma'apilim, Cyrus, the Chashmona, and Bar Kokhba. Those are the four examples we're going to follow. So the first one, of course, you know, is a doomed example of the Ma'apilim. The Ma'apilim are, of course, this group of people who are so distraught with the outcome of what happened with the spies. The spies come back, they give the bad word about the land of Israel. Hashem says, that's it, and the book is closed. This generation is going to die in the desert. You're not going to enter Israel, the next generation will enter. And the people were in mourning. Now, they were in mourning the night before because they thought that they were going to the land of Israel. But nonetheless, they realized the impact and the gravity of this decision. So what do? So here they are. They say, no, we sinned. We did the wrong thing, but we're going to do it. We're going to charge in. We're going to go into the land of Israel. We're going to take over. Now's not the time. Don't go. Don't go, you'll be destroyed. And in fact, that's what happens. The Psukim talks about how they presumed they went up to the land and Hashem was not with them. The Aaron was not with them. Moshe was not with them. And they were slaughtered on the southern border of Israel. Amalek and the Canaanite smote them in a place called Chorma, named after that destruction. So, you know, there's a certain time where we aspire to do what we feel is the right thing. We want to enter the land of Israel. We do it forcefully, but God says this is not the right time. And it ends in destruction. Mm-hmm. Episode number one. Episode number two, we move many, many centuries later into Tanakh, into what is really a fascinating stage in history, because what's happened over here is that there's been the rise of this Babylonian Empire. The Babylonian Empire has been violent, and it with an extremely fast rise, conquering the whole near and Middle East, and their policies are pretty violent. They destroy every nation, exile every nation that they come across. But as fast as it descends equally as fast, and is conquered by the much more organized, much more slow-moving Persian Empire, which lasts much longer than it. And under one of the Persian emperors, Cyrus the Great, this picture's there on the right, this is how the book of Ezra actually begins. Let's see if we can get into it. I know we can't get into the text as easily. I apologize. But just to get a sense of this, listen to the way that Tanakh describes this. And I think that if only we could read the newspaper with these type of eyes. Meaning, like, if we could just be able to see what the newspaper through through this lens. I apologize, I can't get any closer right now. Just to do the first pasuk. Vishnas achas lekoresh melech pras. In the first year of Cyrus the Great, the king of Persia, lachalois tevar Hashem mipir Yirmiyahu, that the time when the end of Yirmiyahu's prophecy was coming into effect, Heir Hashem es ruach koresh melech pros vayaver kol b'chol malchusoy v'gam b'michtov lemor. Hashem inspired Cyrus the Great. Cyrus was not a Jew. Cyrus was a Persian emperor. Cyrus the Great was inspired by God, and he wrote the following letter. Komar melech koresh melech pros. So saith Cyrus of Persia. Komam lachos oretz nosan Hashem lokeo shemayim v'upalkad alai livnois be'eloi bayis b'Yerushalayim Hashem Yehuda. God gave me the entire world. And by the way, he pretty much means that. You know what I'm saying? Like when we talk about Ahasuerus, wherever we put him in the timeline in relationship to Koresh. But Ahasuerus, you know, we talk about 127 states. We talk about from India, you know, well into Europe. So, you know, Cyrus is pretty, you know, pretty on target by saying, you know, God gave me the whole world. And he says, and the reason why I have it is to establish the house of God in Jerusalem. And he goes on and he talks about take the gold, take the vessels, take everything you have, and go back. Go to the land of Israel. Wow. You know, we have to ask ourselves, you know, did he really say that in the name of God? You know what I mean? Like to say, was that us saying we know that he said it, meaning we know that Hashem inspired him, or that he felt that he was inspired by God, right? But nonetheless, this is what he does. And he sends out this mandate, we'll call this the Cyrus Declaration. And the Cyrus Declaration was a very successful declaration. But the question is, what happened? What happened afterwards? So if you go into the later prokim in Ezra, there's a long list of people who come up and listen to the sum total people who respond to this declaration. Kol ha'kol ke'echot arbo riboy alpaim shlosh meos shishim. An unbelievable 42,303 score. Now folks, we don't have to do a census for Jewry in Persia and Babylon at the time to realize that 42,000 is a drop in the bucket. Okay, to it means to say, here is Cyrus the Great, and he's set up this vassal state, and he's going to be governed by Jews, and he sends up, you know, he sends up the spiritual leader, and he sends up the governor, right? So at first it was, you know, before his time it was Zerubbabel, Yeshua, Kohen Gadol. Now this point in time it's going to be Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra's the sofer, the scribe, and Nehemiah's going to be the governor. He was a very high politically connected Jew in the Persian court. He was the drinks master of the emperor. Nonetheless, you know, in the end of the day, the response is pitiful. And in fact, the Gemara comments on this. The Gemara says, well, you know what? The Gemara says the following. Here we go. It says, Ad yavor ni oz yashir. Ad yavor amcho Hashem. Ad yavor amzukon yisa. You know, until you come up the nation of Hashem, until you can acquire this nation. The Gemara says, Ad yavor amcho Hashem zul bi rishon. The first time we came to Israel. Ad yavor amzukon yisa zul bi shnia. Mikanam ruchachomim. Ru'uimo Yisrael le'osos v'hem neis b'mei Ezra k'derek sh'nasu v'hem neis b'mei Yoshua nun. El shogar machet. We could have had the same degree of miracles as we entered or we re-entered the land at the times of Ezra, as Ezra was sent by Koresh, but we didn't have the schus, shegara machet, that sin overtook us. What sin overtook us? The Gemara in Yuma says, over here, also quoting Shir HaShirim, a little late in Shir HaShirim, Im choy mo'aleh nivne aleh tiras kesef, vim delesi notzur aleh luach erez. If it is a wall, we'll build on it a beautiful crown of silver. But if it's only a door, then we'll make a luach erez. We'll make a cedar board on it. If you're to make yourself like a wall and ascended all together in the times of Ezra, then nimshaltim lakakesef, you would be like silver. K'she'ein rekev sholet bo. There's no rot that controls it. Nimshaltim rekev sholet bo. It looked nice at the beginning, you know, as all good wood does. And then, you know, give it a few years, and that's what the wood looks like at the end. It wasn't long-lasting. It wasn't going to be long-lasting. Why? What was Shogar HaMachet according to the Gemara in Yuma? Because we were quite happy with our estates in Babylon. You know, Shushan was just a fantastic, the municipalities were good, the taxes were easy, jobs were fine, everything was good. So why did we need to go up to Israel? We missed the boat. So here you see something in the opposite side. You know, the Ma'apilim wanted to go up and it was the wrong time. These are the folks who should have got up and it was the right time. They missed going up and it became the wrong time because they didn't take advantage of it. When we read, by the way, if we read Ezra and Nehemiah and Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, which are all in the same, this the same bracket of time, I mean, it's almost as if we're reading history now. It's remarkable this how similar it is to now. Now, it happens to be that these two episodes, the Ma'apilim and the Koresh, are a little less helpful to us in certain instances because, in a certain perspective. You know why? It's because they had prophecy. So Moshe could say, uh-uh, and Ezra could say, yeah, right? Meaning to say, like, in the end of the day, we knew what was right and wrong. So the prophets could tell us what was right, what was wrong, so we could follow, and we'd know we're doing the right or wrong thing. Mm-hmm. What about times after prophecy, where we no longer have that to tap in, and we say, okay, so what do we do now? Well, there's nobody. Now we have to think about it. We have to actually work it out. So it happens to be two fascinating instances. The Chashmonaim. The Chashmonaim are living in a post-prophetic era, Second Temple. We're living in a time where now the Persians have been conquered by the Greeks. The Greeks are controlling the emperor. The Greek empire turns into four, splits into four splinters. The Syrian Greeks under Antiochus are in charge of this particular area of the Greek empire. And this is the Megillas Antiochus, which describes, you know, the story where Yochanan is brought in front of one of these this fellow whose name was Nicanor, and it forces him to try to bring a sacrifice of a pig on this altar. And at this point in time, Yochanan makes this proclamation, and he says, "Bo'ezah he nosa Yochanan ben Matzisiyahu einov l'shemayim v'tiken tefilosa lifnei Elokav v'yomer Elokai v'Elokei Avosai Avram Yisrael Yaakov al titneini nabi yidei ha'orel hazeh. Don't allow me to suffer in front of this uncircumcised person. Ki im yargeni v'yelech v'yishtakach v'veis dagoin Elokav v'yomer Elokai nosnu v'yodi. You're going to let him kill me? He's going to go to his house of worship and say, ah, look what their God does. At this moment in time, Yochanan takes the sword and he assassinates the representative of the government. And this is the beginning of this stage of the rebellion, where Yochanan and his sons now move into exile into the caves of the hills. And this is where the whole Chanukah episode starts. Many wars that are fought against the reprisal of Greeks and Judo Greeks that ensues after this. And you say to yourself, you know, like, well, how did he know? Meaning, like, here he is, you know, at this point in time. So shouldn't you say, okay, well, you know, Shelo Yalu B'Choma? No. We're not doing anything. Passive. He says it. I got to do it. Right? That's not what's happening. He leads now one of the most successful rebellions in all of Jewish history against the powers that be. Meaning to say, he believed and he knew this was correct. The Rambam says, in fact, the reason why we celebrate Chanukah is because the sovereignty gained by the Chashmonaim, which lasted for over 200 years, included in that were many bad kings, bad, bad Jewish kings. Right? There was Herod who killed all the Chashmonaim, every single one, last one of them. It was when there was civil war between Aristobulus and Hyrcanus of the Chashmonaim dynasty. That was all included. What the Rambam says is we celebrate Chanukah because of this, because of that proactivity to take back the land of Israel. Let's go further. We move to centuries later, after the destruction of the Second Temple, the years 130 to 135, where there is, of course, the famous Bar Kokhba rebellion. And the Bar Kokhba rebellion wasn't just a military rebellion. In fact, as the Rambam tells us, as the Gemara in Yerushalmi describes, in the end of the day, Rabbi Akiva believed in this. Rabbi Akiva really believed this had the potential to be the Messiah. This was the potential to be Achishena in a certain sense. You know, Be'ito Achishena, if we have the schus, we can get there. Bar Kokhba did not work out so well. He killed the sages. He was not he did not, in the end of the day, live up to the signs that he had. But nonetheless, this could have been. There was a potential of it having been something which could have been a success. And we think, and unfortunately, throughout the rest of Jewish history, with few and far in between exceptions, there was very little opportunities ever to return, to exercise any sovereignty or military or diplomatic sovereignty until actually very recently. Just for the sake of time, what we're going to do is we're going to skip the development of, you know, the historical development of Zionism throughout the 19th century and the different groups within the Zionism, because there's a fascinating, in and of itself is just a discussion about who supported, didn't support, did you become part of it, the social dynamics of Zionism, Zionist Congress, Theodor Herzl. We return to the Balfour Declaration itself with a short background. In this context, the Balfour Declaration is different to Zionism, just to appreciate this for a second. Just to appreciate this. There's one thing when a Zionist group comes to a city and says, we're going to all go to Israel, we're going to make Aliyah, we're going to learn Hebrew, we're going to now throw anti-Semitism as well as the past, we're going to get recognition, we're going to find our own sovereign state. You know, so there was a lot of debate. You know, do we accept that? Do we not accept that? The tone of this is, at best, apathy to religion, at worst, anti-religion. So you know, there's a lot of debate. The predominant Orthodox view was against Zionism. You know, just to be clear, there was, of course, religious Zionists, but the predominant, if you were to speak to most Hasidic communities and most communities in the yeshiva world, they were not in support of Zionism, certainly because of the leadership of Zionism. But what happened when the Balfour Declaration happened? The Balfour Declaration is a little different. The Balfour Declaration is different because this is now actually somebody from the outside saying, hey, you're right. This sounds almost like it's that Cyrus moment for like yeah, where it sounds like God is, you know, putting his hand into the puppet of this leader now and doing something. So how do you react to that? How do you react to that? How do we look at that? What I want to do is I want to take the next few minutes to look at three types of responses which inform us today. Negative, positive, and more nuanced. And within each, three characters. That's our movement here. In the negative side of things, so the people who are more concerned about this, an example, of course, would be the Satmar Rebbe, Rav Yoel Teitelbaum, who later on wrote a book called called Vayoel Moshe, and it was the first of the three sections of that book is called the Shalosh Shavuos, in which he reestablishes firmly our role as being an exiled Jew and not fighting against the powers that be around us. I want to just also be fair. You know, sometimes people will put up the Satmar Rebbe as a foil, you know, as a straw man they want to knock down. I think it really would do us intellectual honesty to read Vayoel Moshe before dismissing what he says. The Vayoel Moshe is a complex and in-depth halachic work. It's not simply demagoguery, you know, where sometimes people would put out there. The Rav Yoel Teitelbaum was a gadol shebigdolim. He was an incredibly huge spiritual leader. So, you know, we may disagree with the perspective, but just to appreciate that it wasn't simply a stamping the foot and saying, this is what I believe. It was a much more bigger perspective. Here's what he says. I won't say this, we could go back over here. This is what he says over here in his book, Divrei Yoel and Tori. He says the following. Why is it that we didn't reach these things? Why was it that it didn't succeed so well in the times of the Second Temple? Because it was built under Persian rule. Hagam shayo al pi hanavua, shisnabu ole al chagai zecharia melochi, v'korech melech kosher hayo. It's true. Koresh was a great man. So he was a good, Jew-loving, fair man. And by the way, he issued stoppings of the building of the Beis Hamikdash later on. Our Tachshasta didn't work out so easily. There were people who didn't like us building then as well. Right? But nonetheless, he was a good man. Chagai zecharia melochi talked about it. Afo pi chen lefi shayo b'siyua umas ha'olam lo efshar liyois al tzad ha'shlemus. Simply stated, the reason the second Beis Hamikdash was not Mashiach wasn't because we didn't come up together. It was because we cannot have the model of Geula is not via other people. The model of Geula is not via Cyrus. The model of Geula is HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes in, splits the Persian Empire into two, destroys all the enemies, leads Israel miraculously back into the land, and boom, Geula comes. That's the way it happens. That's all that is, that's the only method, the only model that Geula can happen. And he goes on to prove it. Therefore, why was it short-lived? Because it was. You have to imagine, just to appreciate this. In that Beis Hamikdash, there was a wall, there was a mural in the Beis Hamikdash called Shushan. It had a mural of the skyscape of Shushan. Think about that. Imagine the Beis Hamikdash being built today, you know, with the New York skyline because we, you know, like New York Jews supported the building of the Beis Hamikdash. What a travesty. Like that's what we think about the Beis Hamikdash is, you know, the Manhattan skyline? Like, that's what it was, says the Satmar Rebbe. The Satmar Rebbe says, I'm just going to hold Christian for the end just for the second. In the end of the day, it was a lowly building. It was a lowly second temple, which is why we cried when it was made, because it was with the help of the Umos Olam. There happens to be another fascinating letter which was sent at this around this time. Let's see if we can get into it. I can't actually access it. It was a statement made by Rav Yitzhak Meir Levine. Rav Yitzhak Meir Levine was a fascinating individual in history. He was a son-in-law of the Gerer Rebbe. And of course, the Gerer Rebbe was one of the Hasidic sects which was more open to Zionism in general, and he was criticized deeply because of that. He said when he made a statement about the divine inspiration of Balfour when proclaiming this declaration in 1917. He was actually one of the 37 people to sign the Israeli Declaration of Independence. It's a fascinating story behind that. He was in Jerusalem. He had a broken leg. They flew him in a plane. He had his leg out of the plane. He got to just before Shabbos. Remember, this is the fifth. This is literally as Shabbos was coming in. You know, they didn't have the name of Hashem in the Declaration of Independence. The closest they got was to put the word Tzur, you know, the Rock of Israel. So, you know, that was, it was a big debate, and that is still, you know, if you look at the Scroll of Independence, we have it up in the library. There is a, on the wall, thanks to Mr. Aminoff, who put it up there, there's, you know, you can see there's no mention of Israel. So if you look at his signature, he says at the end of his signature, Be'ezros Hashem Yisborach. Right, so it is there. So anyway, so it's like, just so you should know, that way he got it in, you know. He was a very fascinating person, you know, very formative in Agudas Yisrael. It's an abbreviation. Nonetheless, you know, a very fascinating individual. He talked about the inspiration of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, HaShkoch HaShem, that the Balfour Declaration would happen, and in response to this, a very strong letter came out, a response, a heavy response, a protest letter from the Yerayim in Yerushalayim, for those who fear in Yerushalayim against this, you know, it's quoting him, and they go on. Chas v'shalom, that we should look at this as some sort of divine command, says this group of individuals. Right? Ki on tzrichim la'amin bepashtus bebias Mashiach amiti shirak hu. It's only going to come from Hashem. Like, what are you saying? You know, like, you know what? You're flattering these people because you think they're going to give you more power, right? So this is in response to, you know, the Gerer Rebbe's son-in-law. You know, this is how strongly worded it was. There are other letters sent by other communities in Yerushalayim, also Haredim in Yerushalayim, who support it. But we're not going to spend time going through it because there's so much of yeah. The Munkach Rebbe, the Minchas Elozar. Says the following, of course, also very vehemently opposed. Says Rak Hoyum Vusosim Misimcha Besimcha Hamanda Shall Bal Poor Mi London. What is he saying?
That's
great. Balfour, of course, is an acronym for Bal Poor, which was the area in the desert in which Israel served Avodah Zarah, called Bal Poor. So, what's the Minchas Elozar say? Minchas Elozar says. Again, a master, a leader in Israel says, this is Avodah Zarah. Following this is you're following the Pied Piper over the precipice. That's what he's saying, right? Imki tzavachti v'itpasti oz mikoidim hoydav v'kol mar tzorit b'shem rabbi seino hagud migdolei harishonim zal ma'ram in Rutenberg v'tashpeitz akot v'chimigdolei achronim. He says, Rabbi Yonasan, he quotes Rabbi Yonasan Abishit, the Sefer Avas Yonasan, Bahtorah. Rabbi Yonasan Abishit says in the Bahtorah of Yeshanan the following. He says, we're never going to go back because we feel we need to have sovereignty. Right? Verotzon. Vagam kol olam ad shigolenu yisporach shemoy al yedei David kumoy shiftach hiftichenu. The only way we're going to get back there is when Hashem sends David Melech, Melech Mashiach, and that's how we're going to get back there. There is no other alternative. Now again, this is we're taking a snippet out of much longer essays. Out of much more, there's much. Oh, we have a descendant of the Michilas Elazar. In the end of the day, this is really, it's not fair to be able to just do a little snippet, but just to appreciate what is our role in Golus. Our role in Golus is to do mitzvahs, to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and wait for Hashem to bring the ultimate gula. It's not our role to go fraternizing with politicians, to go diplomatically trying to advance the next stage. This is our role. And the degree that we'll be safe is the degree we don't force the issue. And just to appreciate this, from this camp over here, they will say that it was not worth the lives lost to create the state of Israel. It was not worth all those lives because ultimately speaking, it would have been better to remain a subsidiary nation under a foreign power and serve Hashem that way rather than to have forced this. And they would say that everything bad that goes on, every terror attack, every loss in the army is because we caused it ourselves. I mean, we put ourselves in the situation where we could have stayed in Europe, we could have stayed in all these other places. Now, unfortunately, you know, we know, unfortunately, that 1939 to 1945 changed things. I would also add another thing. Just historically speaking, just as something to think chew on. If you read a summary to Ali Khomeini's book, Ayatollah Khomeini. So he wrote a book on Israel. It's worthwhile reading because, you know, if you want to know what people want to do, they usually put in their book. You know, Hitler was pretty clear about that, right? So you've got to read the people's books, right? So Ali Khomeini has a book about Israel. And he talks about Israel. He doesn't want to nuke Israel. That's not his plan. You know what his plan is? He wants to carry on financing terror and disquiet in the nation, what he calls a constant simmer in the land, to drive out the European non-inhabitant Jews who weren't belonging in the land of Israel, so they can go back, and that the rest of the Jews who were indigenous, because he doesn't disagree that there were Jews living there for centuries, should live in a subsidiary state to Islam. Right? As they did in Syria and Iraq and Persia and all the other places across the Muslim world. Now, when you say, let them be returned to the status of Dhimma, but they don't have the right to wield power over Islam. And so just to appreciate it, when you hear anybody saying something which sounds similar to Ayatollah Khomeini, that's usually a bad sign. Okay, so just appreciate that. Meaning if our attitude to Gola sounds like the same thing as Ayatollah Khomeini is saying, that's generally a red flag. So, but nonetheless, just to appreciate that historically speaking, what's going on. What about the positive side over here? On the positive side, most famously, is the letter of Rav Meir Simcha Divinsk, the Eloi of Divinsk. He was the contemporary of the Rogatchover, and he says the following. He says, this is the most famous response to the Balfour Declaration. He passed away, really, literally, he passed away in 1924. So in 1917, this is the end of his years, the Meshech Chochma on the Torah, or Sameach on the Rambam, the Go'ain Sheba Go'ainim. He says the following. Here we go. He says, he talks about Rav Yehuda, who wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael, and how important it was to him. He goes the following. Yeah, let's just cut to the chase. Omnam ka'es ha-sivo ha-shkocho asher ba-sifas ha-mamlachus ha-na'urois b'san rimoi. So he's now referring to the 1920 San Remo conference. And he says, now that there's been legitimacy in the eyes of the world, nitan tzav asher Eretz Yisrael tiye la'am Yisrael, there's a command, or there's a mandate, that there's going to be Israel's return to Israel. V'kevan shesar pachad hashvuas v'rishoyin ha-malachim koma mitzas im yishuv Eretz Yisrael sheshkula keneged kol ha-mitzas shebatorah. He says, what is he saying? Sar pachad hashvuas. What does he mean? Yes, it's true. For all of almost 2,000 years, we were to live as a subsidiary, as the lowly Jew, saying, yes, sir, no, sir. But we know what happens. When the nations of the world get together and in an unprecedented action give legitimacy to a Jewish homeland, a Jewish national homeland, then you know what? Sar pachad hashvuas. They're allowing us to do it. Therefore, the mitzvah returns al tila, and he says, everybody should be doing this to the best of their ability, says the Meshech Chochma. It is pivoted. History has changed. The Shvuas are over. Wow. You have to have shoulders to be able to say that. And you say, he's saying there's a limitation in the Gemara Ksubas and we've reached it. That's why that's the way he looked at it. That's just to appreciate the gravity of this. Of course, Rav Kook. Remember, most people think Rav Kook, you know, Rav Kook is the ultimate Zionist, you know, religious Zionist. Just to appreciate, you know, Rav Kook was a Talmud in Volozhin, you know, and you know, under Reb Chaim. Rav Kook is, you know, came from the depths of the European system of yeshivas. He's a poisek otzer. I mean, we're not talking about somebody who was just, you know, he didn't even live to see the state of Israel. He died in the 30s. Okay, so but he was around for the Balfour Declaration. Listen to the following. Because I'm going to read over here because it's a little less fuzzy. I'm Rimal Balfour. He quotes, this is when Balfour died. He gave a eulogy. He gave a eulogy for Balfour. Omrim al Balfour, shehu doime betzirason lekoresh melech pras b'shaatoi. It's as if he's like Cyrus the Great. The British Empire at this point in time, you may argue if it's at its peak or it's already on its way down, but Britain controlled at a certain point, you know, coming from the 19th century to the 20th century, more landmass than any other country occupied in the world at any time. He says, shehu gam hu bal hatzoras hakadosh shel mi bochem mikoam he's even better than Koresh. He's better than Cyrus the Great, he says. Koresh oya melech kosher b'sha shenosan es ha-tahara. Aval lo yamad b'kashu soy v'hechmitz. Cyrus, you know, as all good politicians do, sway in the wind. Right, depending on which wind was blowing, he went in that direction. Later on, he retracted his permission. Later on, Cyrus said, well, the people in Shomron are complaining, the Jews weren't letting them build with them, they didn't want to, and so therefore he sent a letter retracting it, and the Beis HaMikdash granted a stop, right? In the end of the day, who hechmitz alidei ha-intrigios shel tzar Yehuda, the intrigue of those around us alidei ha-yumim, shebibinyan ha-bayis, ha-urad ha-anvo aretz yikalkel sa-yichosim shel ha-politikia ha-rechoy kolon. He goes the following, he says, just skipping down. Aval Balfour, loy hechmitz. Balfour did not change. Hu omad betzidkoi mitchilas his noitzutzus shel harayon agadol hazeh b'moichoi. He stayed with the idea the whole way through. She hivrik a love mitoich hashpa niflos shel sipureinu hagadol shemegiloseinu hachezionis ad soifoi ad nishimosoi ha'achrona. To his last dying day, he still believed in what he said. Alken yezichroi boruch lonu la'ad. That was his hesped for Balfour. Can you imagine? Anyway, so this is the way Rav Kook sees it. Rav Kook, of course, in his letter, this letter was sent out 2 days after the Balfour Declaration, describing how he views this as HaKadosh Baruch Hu, his galus ba'olam, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is shining his light on us in the world. Whenever had a nation ever given us permission to do this in all of Galus history? And he reiterates this in another letter later on in Shvat, just the same year in the Jewish calendar. Very unequivocally clear. Rav Moshe Yaakov Moshe Chalap. Actually, Rav Yaakov Moshe Chalap was one of the Talmidei Muvhak of Rav Kook, and he later on became the Rav of Shari Chesed in Yerushalayim. So whenever we walk in the streets of Shari Chesed, the Rav of Shari Chesed, Rav Yaakov Moshe Chalap, his grandson, of course, is Rav Zvulun Chalap, who is the Dean of Ritz in YU for many, many years. He's still the Dean Emeritus. You can, whenever you meet him, whenever you meet Rav Chalap and you ask him, you can ask him for memories for his grandfather, Rav Yaakov Moshe, one of the geniuses, one of the great leaders of the time. And he is very much in favor of this Balfour Declaration. He says the following. We're not going to read it inside just for the sake of time, but he says the following in his sefer called Ma'ane HaYeshua, the springs of redemption, of salvation. He says the following. It's true, you want to know, well, is it going to be miraculous? Is it not going to be miraculous? Remember the Satmar Rebbe was saying that we have to look at it, and that Gula is going to be totally and unadulteratedly miraculous. So how do you deal with that? So he says, well, let's look back at Galus Mitzrayim. He says, in Galus Mitzrayim, there was a lot of Hishtadlus necessary to be done till the point that Hashem stepped in. There was a lot of tefillah, there was a lot of fighting, there was a lot of working with the powers before we got to that point that suddenly it all became miraculous. Then he says an interesting thing, and he says, this is just a thought to think about. He says the Balfour Declaration itself was miraculous. Meaning, like, what in the world was he doing? Like, why? You know, the Jews constituted, there were, you know, 300,000 Jews in Britain at the time. But, like, you know, in the end of the day, did he really need us? You know, there's lots of intrigue and what Britain's interests were and what they were trying to do, maybe the swing the Jews of Russia, and whatever, you know, all the intrigue that goes into why the Balfour Declaration was issued. It was meshuggah. Some historians say that this was the most... the most unlikely document issued in the entire 20th century. I mean, yes, you see, that is a miracle that it was issued in the first place. I mean, don't say, well, we need Hashem to break through the clouds and split the earth. What the miracle is when He makes people do things which they should never have done. That's a miracle, says Rav Yaakov Moshe Chalap. Come into the more nuanced approaches. We've seen some of the positive approaches. We've seen some of the negative approaches. What about the nuanced approaches? What about the Chofetz Chaim? The Chofetz Chaim was around. The Chofetz Chaim, when he died in the 1930s as well. What did he say? He was around. People asked him. He was the God of Ador at the time. He was already recognized worldwide. So the Chofetz Chaim has more of a nuanced approach. Listen to what he says. He says in Sefer Shem Olam, V'yesh HaKadosh Baruch Hu noisem b'lev malchei ha'umas she'akiru kulam ha'achas v'yirtzu lahitiv Yisrael. So there's times where Hashem will make it that the nations of the world will want to do good to Israel. Ki'inyan she'ne'emar b'koiresh He gave this mandate. He says, "Klal advarim lo yimnag me'akolish baruch u'shim siva la'ashlamas cheftzai." I'm just to see the words a little better this way. V'zehu shekosu v'harbei moi pedus. Harbei moi pedus means to say that Hashem has many tools in His box. Don't limit HaKadosh Baruch Hu to only one way of providing geula. HaKadosh Baruch Hu can provide geula, even when it seems like the tools he is using are a little, you know, strange. You know, Koresh, okay, you know, you know, he's, you know, good man for the Persians and everything, you know. But, like, you know, was he really, you know, was he the kind of tool that we expected to geula to come through? No, but that's the way he chose. Is Balfour the kind of your upstanding citizen of, you know, to go on the annals of Jewish history? Well, we wouldn't have chosen him ourselves, but Hashem has tools. A little more nuanced, though, in his response. In the Chofetz Chaim on the Torah, it's quoted by his son, Reb Leib. Ha'imasapi shemshah shememsholas ha'anglia pirsumos ha'balfour ha'declaratio ha'yodua al-dovar Eretz Yisrael ra'a ha'Chofetz Chaim bozeh to say sort of the Shemaim from the heavens that Hashem was inspiring the next step of the Gula. He says, he talked about Hashem talks about establishing the rod of Yehuda, and this is going to be the Gula. Aval Omar, but he also said, he's worried that those free, the fry Jews, the Jews who are not observant of Torah and Mitzvahs, would misuse this opportunity. He says, look back in Jewish history, there were many good moments, and there were many windows of opportunity. Not all of them did we take. So what his concern was, is maybe, you know, Hashem, there's no question, says the Chavetz Chaim, this is godly. But as godly as it is, the question is, are we going to take advantage of it? Or are we going to misappropriate that power that was given to us? Are we going to misappropriate this moment? So the Chavetz Chaim was tenaciously, he was obviously embracing, this is clearly a sign from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but will we use it? Will we misuse it? That's just this hesitation, just the sign of nuance over here in his work, in his legacy. Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, the Rav of Yerushalayim, the founder of the Eda Charedis, also a contemporary of Rav Kook, and we know the relationship, the fond relationship Rav Kook and Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld actually themselves had together. Not so simple. He had also much more of a nuance, depending on the different levels of biography that he had, more of a nuanced approach to this whole business. As an example, here we go. We're not going to go through all of this over here. Let's skip this one over here. He says, "Pona le'echad mimekroiv avesachloi ledati tzrichim onu lesakein mechadosh eseder tikon chatzos boy onu mekoyanim al golus hashchina." So we need to reestablish. There's a practice in Judaism called Tikkun Chatzos, where Jews would get up at midnight and pray and cry for the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. It's brought in Shulchan Aruch in the first four Se'efim. He says the following: "What ki batuach ani sheha'adus ha'charedis nichnasa ato lema'arocha chadosha akuva midam." It's going to be a very difficult time in the future. Who Rabbeinu shaya kol yomav min hamoy min hatoimchim. He wanted the land to be reestablished. He felt that there was something dangerous that was going to happen because of this. And by the way, he was right to a certain degree about the danger that was about to ensue. The 1920 Arab riots, which started, leading to the 1929 massacre in Jerusalem and in Hebron, the issuing of the Peel Commission and the White Paper. There's a lot of blood that's going to be spilt in the next two decades, and following that, because of this ultimate movement. What some would say would be the price necessary to get there, what he would say is the danger of this next step. We're not going to go through all his works, but he understands that there's a great inspiration, there's a great opportunity at this moment in time, but as well, it comes with a great danger. It's not something we can take lightly. I want to just end with the words of the Borensteins. Who are the Borensteins? And this we'll close with. Is the Avnei Nezer and his son, the Shemi Shmuel. Who were the Avnei Nezer? Who was the Shemi Shmuel? The Avnei Nezer was a great poisek. He was, in fact, the son-in-law of the Kotzker Rebbe, created his own dynasty in Sokotchov, became the first Sokotchov Rebbe. And he was renowned for his psakim across the board, across Europe, which are recorded in his books called the Avnei Nezer. He is also famous for having been the author of a book called Eglei Tal on Hilchos Shabbos. If you're learning Hilchos Shabbos, it's a necessary in order to be able to learn Hilchos Shabbos. He has thousands of chassidim in Sokotchov, and he talks about the following. He is talking before the Balfour Declaration, as you can see. He lived till 1910. He did not see the Balfour Declaration. He is dealing more on a halachic level with the Shalosh Shvuos, our role in Golos. And he goes through an extremely long halachic analysis. So let's not ignore that. There's pages and pages and pages that he spends talking about this. But the following is his conclusion. He says, Uladina, le halacha. He's not saying le machshava. He's saying ledina. Le halacha. Hitzrich le linyonenu lamada kamalon karova poiskim de kidsha le osid lavoi im oilem. So he says that if a person goes up to Eretz Yisrael, we know that the Kedusha remains in Israel. And there's today, he says, you can go up. He's talking in the end of the 19th century. You can still get a Parnasa there, he says. Right? And this is now a mitzvah which is equally equal to all our mitzvahs together. But It is circumscribed by our ability to be able to get rishus, permission to go there. We cannot break naval blockades. We can't force our way in with visas that are not correct to get to the land. Why? Because that's part of the shadow of the Shavuos, right? That he still firmly believes that we're within that construct. And of course, there are many Jews going to Israel. Make sure that your destination is going to be a place where you have Torah. Clear, right? Right, he says, and therefore, it is a great mitzvah to involve yourself diplomatically to allow people to go up. Because see what he's doing over here? It is a problem of Aliyah Bachoma to go up forcefully, militarily. But what can you do? Diplomatically, it's not a transgression of that. So do everything you can to allow the governments to allow you to go, because then it's a mitzvah gedolah that you're fulfilling, says Avner Nezer in his tshuva. That's what he says. And he goes on to say, and he blesses the hands of those people who do that. Remarkable. So still within the shadow of the Shavuos, nonetheless, also saying we should do it. We should do every effort we can diplomatically within rules to be able to do that. Now, he didn't just speak. He put his money where his mouth was. He sent his son to go and start establishing a part of the Yishuv. He really believed in this firmly. Interestingly enough, his son who followed in his footsteps, the Shem Yishmuel, the grandson of the Kotzk Rebbe, the son of the Avnei Nezer, Rav Shmuel Borenstein, was actually a little more hesitant. He wasn't as gung-ho as the Avnei Nezer, and after the Avnei Nezer's death, historically speaking, he slowed down on his lahavus, the excitement about the Zionist prospect, until the Balfour Declaration. And this is why it's so fascinating. Meaning to say, he was concerned about the social aspects of it, from the type of crowd, the leadership, where this is going. But what happened? At the Balfour Declaration, this is as recorded in Avir Haroim, it describes how, and he quotes in Ibn Ezra on Megillas Esther, it says that Esther didn't come to the feast on the first. She didn't say, you know, Esther invites the king and Muhammad to a feast, and then the second, and then she invites them to a different feast. Why does she invite them to a different feast? She's because she saw that the Jews were busy fasting, everybody was busy praying, and she hadn't seen any sign, anything that had happened yet, which showed her that the tide had changed in God's mind. She had to wait. She was waiting for a sign to see that the tide might change. Something happened. What changed, by the way? What happened in the second Suda? Balalahu, not Allah Shah Zamelach, and Haman's led in the streets. No, it's not just that what happened to the kings. What happened was the poor Mordechai, who was slated for destruction, was led through the streets by Haman. Says Esther, can you deny the Hashkocha in that? Of course, now's the time. The second feast is the time to now take advantage, to move forward. Says the Shem Yishmuel, it may have been that up till now, it may not have been the right thing, the right way, the right people, potentially. But you know what? When HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends you a Lord Balfour Declaration, there's no two ways about it. This is it. This is HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaking to us. This is the Sarus Adela Ela. Meaning to say, there's a more nuance over here. He saw both sides of the station. And nonetheless, he was able to pull through. This is how he ends. I want to just close with the following remark, which I think is really a powerful way to conclude. You know, thinking about this, that you know, Chaim Weizmann, when in his discussions with Harry Truman, said to President Truman, and this was about later on the British mandate vote. He said, President Truman, this interview which took so long to get. He said, President Truman, understand something. He says, if you ever decide to help the Jewish people in history, your name will be remembered forever. He says, Mr. Truman, you have a chance on the vote. That's what he said to him. Think about that for a second. Do we know any other Prime Minister of England pre-Churchill? I mean, Neville Chamberlain and Churchill. Do we know anybody? Do we care about anybody? Is it important in our history? Think about the accolades that we have over here in terms of an individual who finished his term in 1906 and integrally involved in Jewish history. Because you know what? It may be imperfect. It may not be the way we thought it would be. But when we see something like that, we see somebody doing something astonishingly different to what anybody would ever expect, then we realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is pulling the strings of history, and that's worth celebrating. Thank you very much. Yeah. ואחד מן הקשורים לצעקו שברוך לזעקו, אסס שעולה ויחר, חיר בעולה, תרמיסו, שנמר נחו.